Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome back to News and Views. I'm Rob Schofield. When it comes to analyzing the data surrounding the lives of children in our state and the laws and policies that affect them, no organization does a better job than NC Child. Recently, I had the opportunity to sit down for a special extended interview with the organization's research director, Whitney Tucker, in which we discussed childhood poverty and this year's Child Health Report Card. Well, it's great to be joined again by our friend Whitney Tucker from NC Child. Thanks for coming back to be with us on News and Views.
Anytime. I'm so glad to be here.
You've done a lot of work lately. You've been very busy. You've had a series of reports out. Let's talk first about the issue of poverty in North Carolina and childhood poverty. You've had a sort of a three-part series of reports on the subject. Obviously, it continues to be sort of the elephant in the room in North Carolina when it comes to how our children are doing. The reality is that just a maddeningly high percentage of children continue to live in real grinding poverty. Can you tell us a little bit about what you found?
Absolutely. So about 43% of children in North Carolina live in poor or low-income homes. So almost half. And when I say low-income, I'm talking about 200% of the federal poverty level. Because when we talk about children who are living in poverty, that statistic refers to 100% of the federal poverty level. But that level was set back in 1962 based on the cost of food then, right? And it hasn't been updated since.
People talk about poverty as if we know that there's this, you know, you're below the poverty line. But the reality is the standard we use has been obsolete for decades. And the federal government's never updated it or never had the political will to update it.
Absolutely.
And so when you really look at it, you really need to make twice what the federal poverty level is to really not live in poverty, to have something approaching a living income, right?
Yes, and about half of our kids are not right now.
Obviously, it varies a lot. It varies by, as you've said in your report, by race, by place, by age. Talk to us about some of your findings.
So first off, I'll say that young children are more likely than older children to live in poverty.
Because what, their parents are younger and they're just less further along in their lives?
Or so it's some of that, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you are a young child, most of the time your parents are younger and they haven't, you know, had a lot of jobs that, you know, had high wages and things yet, and they haven't really established themselves.
Or they might have to stay home to take care of you.
Mm-hmm. Young children are also more likely to live in families that move from place to place with the seasons for their jobs. You know, so think migrant farm workers, thinking of families that just, you know, rent often and move often. You know, so young families do that all the time. And so that puts young children at risk. So children under five. But then among young children and also, you know, outside of that, we see these huge disparities by race in the state. So American Indian children in North Carolina, Black children, and also Hispanic children are much more likely than white children to live in low-income families here. So Black and Hispanic children make up about 41% of our child population, but about 63% of North Carolina's children in poverty.
That's amazing. And then there's the rural-urban divide. Although we know there are certainly parts of urban areas, Mecklenburg, Wake County, Durham County, where there are intense pockets of very high poverty,
right,
it's still generally a rural-urban divide in the state?
Yeah, so in 2014, the 20 highest poverty rates in the state were all in rural counties. So there is definitely still a lack of opportunity that is concentrated in these rural areas. Although, like you said, I mean, there are these pockets in urban areas where we're seeing really high poverty, even when the neighborhood itself is doing relatively well.
And obviously, when you're living in poverty as a child, it just sets you back. It's a big step to overcome going forward. You're sort of behind the eight ball for going forward, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people know this sort of intuitively,
right,
that, you know, if you start off on a pretty bad foot, then it's really hard to make a way for yourself. But research really backs this up. So
you always hear these stories.
Bootstraps.
I grew up on the dirt road and I overcame, right, which is fine. But even by saying that, they're acknowledging that that's an extraordinary accomplishment that,
absolutely,
most people, that's really tough to do, right?
It's so tough to do. We see, for kids who grow up in poverty, you're less likely than kids who grow up in even median income circumstances to be able to move out of poverty, right? So economic mobility is just lower. But then in poverty, if you grew up as a child living in poverty, you are more likely to have lower test scores. You are more likely to have parents who are involved in the justice system or incarcerated, which then, you know, makes your family life very unstable. You're more likely to be exposed to violence within your home and outside of it. So in your neighborhood, that has a lot to do with where parents can afford to live. You're more likely to go hungry. And then as an adult, you're less likely to make higher wages. So it's harder for you to get those high paying jobs earlier on in life. And then you're also more likely as a child to experience abuse and neglect because poverty has really significant impacts on what researchers call toxic stress in families. And it makes parents more likely to abuse and neglect children, unfortunately. And it has these really long-term effects on just mental health of kids as well.
My gosh, even us who are lucky enough to live in comfortable homes, think about the stressful moments in our lives raising our children. Now think about doing that when you're not sure how you're going to buy food the next day. I mean, it's just, absolutely, it's remarkable that this continues to be the case in 21st century America. And obviously, racial segregation is a factor in this phenomenon as well, right?
It is. So economic mobility that I mentioned, where kids in poverty have a much harder time than kids who grow up, you know, in other circumstances, moving out of poverty or getting to higher wages as adults, that is especially bad due to racial segregation, which, you know, historically in our state was literally codified in most areas, right? But now really persists a lot as income segregation. Right. As an individual, research has found that race isn't a factor that is going to determine whether or not you can move from one income quintile to another. But when we talk about by and large in population level data, it's absolutely a factor because it influences income in our country and in our state.
What are some of the other factors that your report talks about? Transportation and access to education. Talk about those factors.
So childhood poverty and then the ability to move from poverty. So that mobility has been associated with five major characteristics. So there's that racial desegregation that we talked about, but also a smaller income gap between the rich and the poor. So if you live in a place where there is incredibly high poverty, but also neighborhoods that are incredibly wealthy, you are less likely to move out of poverty. And that's just something that researchers have found by tracking a lot of different neighborhoods across the country and also in our state.
We, of course, know that that's a growing trend in our country,
right?
Tragically.
But then also high quality schools are really associated with that economic mobility and being able to grow and learn out of poverty and out of your circumstances. But I think, again, that's something that a lot of people really know intuitively, but we really need policy to support that idea. And then also a high proportion of two-parent households. And it's important to note that research hasn't found that this necessarily means that single-parent households are, you know, incapable of raising children outside of poverty, right?
Yeah,
it's just that having two parents makes it a lot easier for you to pay bills when you have two incomes, right? And then it also provides additional support for kids in the household. But then also social capital. That's the last factor. And that is usually measured as sort of a mashed-up indicator that includes low crime rates in the area, but also high civic engagement, so high voter turnout. A lot of people involved in clubs and sports organizations and going to church and that sort of thing.
Something approaching a thriving community, it has obviously beneficial impacts on all the people who are part of it.
And absolutely. It takes a village, right?
Right. So, my gosh, we only have a minute in this segment, so I can't ask you to list all the things we should do about it. But it seems like at the bottom line here is a recognition that we have to be intentional. This isn't going to go away if we just trust the genius of the market to take care of it. We're going to have to get intentional about attacking this issue. We've been saying that for decades, but we obviously need to recommit ourselves to it.
So, absolutely. I would say there are three primary things we need to really focus on. So, first is ending practices that promote segregation by income and by race and in areas where, you know, those often go hand in hand.
Right.
Second is investing in under-resourced schools in particular. We right now have a system where kids, you know, have to be educated, right? Like that is mandated. But then we put them in circumstances that are vastly different from school to school. And we need to really level that playing field for kids who are growing up in poverty. And then third, I'd say ensuring that residents who already live in under-resourced neighborhoods aren't just limited to the opportunities that are available in their neighborhoods. So investing in things like transportation that can help them get to areas of higher opportunity and help them get to jobs that may pay better, but also letting them be able to branch out from their community to folks with broader social networks than their own, right? So that they can get some more of that social capital that really helps parents to get the opportunities that they need to set a strong foundation for kids to then grow up out of poverty.
It's hard to imagine a more important issue for North Carolina to grapple with as we go well into the 21st century. I really appreciate your calling it to our attention, shining a light on it, something we'll continue to do going forward, I'm certain. Let's move now to another report y'all have recently put out, which is another incredibly important issue in North Carolina, which this is something that NC Child did in coordination with the North Carolina Institute of Medicine, and you do this periodically. It's the Child Health Report Card, which talks about sort of the overall status of the health of our children in North Carolina. And as you might expect, we found some challenges. Talk to us about some of the overall findings.
We found that North Carolina is improving in a lot of areas, but at a rate that's not really fast enough, right? So we're seeing that things are getting slightly better, but that our overall rates for a lot of different really troubling indicators are still very, very high, right? So we only had one A this year in the Child Health Report Card, and that was for insurance coverage.
Okay. Well,
which is largely
good.
Mandated, though, by public policy through the Affordable Care
Act.
That
was the Affordable Care Act, the CHIP program we've had around for years. We've been officially, the lawmakers have been making intentional moves to expand access to health care for children, and it's obviously had a benefit.
Absolutely. So we've seen almost universal coverage, about 95% of kids. And then a lot of research also shows that if we were to expand access to health care coverage for adults, which would then, you know, obviously impact parents, that we could completely close that gap and get to 100% coverage.
Right, because then obviously going to the doctor would become a regular part of parents' lives, and that would obviously bleed over into their kids' lives as well. So, okay, insurance coverage, maybe some hope there, doing some stuff there. Other areas, maybe some other promising developments, but not quite as optimistic.
So we got Bs in environmental health, health services, utilization, and immunization in particular, breastfeeding, and then also teen births, which continue to decline.
Making those go down. Right. That's good. And do we think, can we point to policy decisions we've made or actions, intentional acts, or what do we think is behind some of these improvements?
So with teen births, it's complicated. So national research is kind of split on this because this is also a national phenomenon that teen births have just kind of plummeted in a very short period of time. But a lot of folks are saying that it is intentional public policy that has been in place that has been teaching kids about reproductive health and that sort of thing in schools, but then also the impact of things like Teen Mom, the TV show, right? And being able to see more of that. But also just generally the discourse socially has kind of changed for younger people in terms of what we're looking for in our lives, right?
We've got some A's for insurance, B's and some others. There's some other areas where we're just sort of treading water, maybe, like education, I see on your list, oral health, maternal health and support. Talk to us about some of those.
All of those things still not really getting better, right? So we've had very similar rates from one year to the next. So when we talk about something like education, right, we're still seeing a high proportion of our kids who are 3 and 4 year olds not enrolled in any sort of school. We're seeing relatively low test scores. Oral health, that data is actually just for kids who are enrolled in Medicaid already, but we're not seeing high oral health utilization, and that actually has a big impact on children's overall health that people don't really talk about that much. But
that's interesting.
If you have an undiagnosed, you know, sort of oral health issue, then that can eventually, in some cases, lead to infection that can reach a child's brain.
Sure.
And that also has a lot to do with poverty, which is something that we've been consistently rated really low on. So we have about 13% of kids who live in high poverty neighborhoods. And that obviously influences a lot of these indicators, right? So, and like we already talked about in the segment on child poverty in the state, about 43% of our kids live in poor, low-income homes. And if your family can't afford barely your rent, then they also are having trouble affording health care that can help you to afford dental care and to get your immunizations on time. And, you know, all of these things really go together. Environmental health. So kids who have been diagnosed with asthma goes hand in hand with kids who are living in poverty and in, you know, conditions where the homes might have...
Good heating systems, exposure to mold.
It's all just this sort of cyclical situation. But I would say that child poverty is the most troubling. But we've also seen a really significant increase in teen suicides.
I wanted to ask you about that because that's just sort of startling and incredibly troubling, the growth in teen suicides and nationally, but here in North Carolina in particular. Talk to us about what your findings are there.
So at this point in North Carolina, suicide is now the second leading cause of death for children 10 to 17. So yeah, it's incredibly common. And we're also seeing, like many of the other indicators that are in the Child Health Report Card, a disparity by race. Black children are more likely than children of other races to have attempted suicide, but less likely to have received mental health care treatment for depression or other disorders that have been linked to thoughts of suicide. that is really showing that there's more we can do on the public policy level to help kids to deal with the emotions that really lead to suicidal ideation.
Like more right. counselors?
Absolutely.
Therapists in schools?
More therapists and counselors in schools. More training available to parents so that they can recognize signs of suicidal ideation. But also some more practical things like policies that limit children's access to things like guns and prescription drugs that they might not actually have been prescribed.
Right.
Because those things are actually really leading causes of suicide when we look at, you know, methods.
Yeah, we know that, for instance, I've read studies that show that obviously firearm suicides are the most, I don't want to use the term successful, but there's not much chance of failing with a firearm as there is from taking an overdose, let's say.
Firearm deaths are very common in our state. And so if we invested in even relatively cheap programs like gun locks, that could make a really big difference in our suicide rate for children. But right now, I mean, it's down to political will, and we're going to have to do something, or there's no reason to think that this trend is not going to continue to rise. Because we also have done very little to reduce barriers to mental health care. So when it comes to affordable healthcare access in general, I know that that's been in sort of the public discourse, but mental health care in particular is very important. A lot of children right now aren't able to access that because their parents don't have health insurance coverage. So they also don't, because research says they go hand in hand.
I hate to take us to even more bad news, but we probably should highlight a few other things where things are not going well. We're not getting good grades for child abuse and neglect, for healthy living and eating, tobacco, alcohol, substance abuse, housing and economic security for our kids. All those are places where North Carolina is getting D's and F's. Are there any things in there that you think maybe really deserve to be held up to the light?
It's hard to put one over the other with those. I think that what we really need to look more at are the things where we're sort of patting ourselves on the back and saying that we're doing a relatively good job, like the B's, like health services utilization and immunization, where you might be able to look over and say, oh, we got to be in this. But the trend is actually going downward, right? So next year, we're likely to have more C's, D's, F's. Right. So for immunization, for example, just about 3/4 of our children under 3 have received their immunizations. But that represents an 11% decline since the last 8 years.
Wow.
Right. So it's mirroring this national trend against immunization, although there is no evidence to support that there are these negative effects on children that people are touting. That has sort of permeated. Right. And that is leading us to have lower immunization rates. That, combined with the difficulty in accessing healthcare, is going to lead to things like worse health outcomes overall. But then if you also have kids with asthma and kids who are having trouble with healthy eating and active living already, right, those trends that we're sort of scoring well on, like immunization and insurance coverage, those things are actually getting worse over time because we're not sustaining them with policy.
So the bottom line is that we're not without hope in this area. We know there are models that work. There are other states that do better. We really just have to apply ourselves and sort of recommit. And it's going to take public policy from our state leaders, right, to bring about intentional solutions to these problems. They're not going to go away on their own. Sure, societal attitudes can help. We've seen that with teen births, perhaps. But we're going to have to really put our shoulders to the wheel to make this thing happen going forward, right?
Absolutely. The Child Health Report Card essentially is creating a menu of options for policymakers and for local leaders to look at and say, these are things that are troubling to us in particular, and this is something that we want to move on. I would especially say that we should really start looking quickly at the child suicide rate so that we can turn that trend around really fast. And that would take concerted policy effort to reduce barriers to mental health care, to reduce access to lethal means of self-harm, so guns, so prescription drugs, those things we talked about. And then also to make sure that there are more trained and caring adults in children's lives who are able to recognize the signs of suicidal ideation. So school counselors, school nurses, school psychologists, and also parents if they need additional support. We need to figure out some programs and find funding to make sure that that is available to families, because increasingly, we're seeing that they need it.
Thank you so much for bringing this to our attention. It's incredibly important work. We hope folks will check it out at ncchild.org, right?
Yes.
They can look for these reports that you've got. Just look under the publications that this incredibly prolific organization cranks out. It's vital. We hope our lawmakers will look at it. And please keep doing this great work for our state.
Thank you. Thank you for raising this up.
Well, that's it for this edition of News and Views. Be sure to check us out online and subscribe to our free newsletters at ncpolicywatch.com. For producer Clayton Henkel, this is Rob Schofield. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to News and Views. A weekly look at state and policy issues is a production of North Carolina Policy Watch. Visit them online at ncpolicywatch.com.